You are listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of January 2018 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, French President Emmanuel Macron has called for China and the EU's relationship to enter the 21st century with improved access for Western companies in the Chinese market. But will Beijing listen? My guests, Daniela Pellet and Michael Goldfarb, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Israel's decision to ban activists that push for a boycott against it from entering the country, and the Saudi Crown Prince's attempts to shed the kingdom's reputation for being ultra-conservative and...
Good evening, ladies and remaining gentlemen. For the male nominees in the room tonight, this is the first time in 3 months it won't be terrifying to hear your name read out loud.
This year's Golden Globes, the first major Hollywood awards ceremony since the outcry over sexual harassment in the industry. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Daniela Pellet, who's the managing editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Michael Goldfarb, veteran journalist and broadcaster. I'm glad to say both very good regulars here on Midori House. Welcome to the programme. Now, French President Emmanuel Macron is currently visiting China. Two things about his trip have made headlines so far. First of all, his rather unusual gift to President Xi Jinping, a horse. And secondly, his aims for China to be further opened up to international businesses in order to bring balance to trading ties. Daniela, what do you make of his trip? It's interesting because, you know, he gets accused at home of being a little bit presidential in his manner, a bit royal in his manner, rather, a bit like a new Sun King. But it kind of works in China, doesn't it? He arrives, he presents the horse, he's full of grand words. There's somehow a presence when he's arrived in China that you imagine probably pleases the Chinese.
Well, he's certainly done it in very, very flamboyant and extravagant style. I mean, the gift of the horse is extremely impressive. I'm only surprised it's not a stallion called Bucephalus. I think Michael was earlier describing him as the first citizen of the of Europe. Yeah. And he is the it's almost become a cliche, but I think we're still within the realms where it's quite encouraging to see Macron flying the flag, essentially, for Europe. Where this will get him with China is a moot point. I mean, China has its own interests.
But just to dive in there, what's interesting is I think many foreign leaders who have met or spoken about Xi Jinping in recent months have felt some kind of like unease about Chinese plans. But in many ways, he said, look, you know, there's a shared economic story between us. You know, we like your idea of this new Silk Road. It's good for everybody. It could work for us as well. So he's in many ways less confrontational than other leaders have been, I think.
Well, certainly Angela Merkel has had a few run-ins with the Chinese and some issues over their takeovers of German businesses and so on. But I mean, I don't think everyone is happy about this this extremely ambitious scheme to basically link the whole world through sea and land routes to China. I mean, China's influence in the region is already massive, and since we seem to be entering an era where there are very few checks and balances on the international stage, with America turning its back rather on the world, I think Macron is taking the point of view that these are the realities, and he can certainly pay lip service, and he can certainly make these grand gestures and sweep in and deliver horses and so on. What is he going to get out of it? Probably as much as anybody else.
Michael, what do you make of France's attempt at diplomacy here?
Well, what I find interesting is, just to pick up on what Daniela was saying at the start of her answer, is, you know, Angela Merkel a year ago would have been described as the first citizen of Europe, and she was seen as now the alternative leader of the West, because America's president just doesn't seem capable of picking up that mantle, both because of who he is as a person, but also the ideology he espouses of making America first and kind of isolationist. But, you know, Angela Merkel has her own political difficulties at the moment, and she's trying to pull together a new coalition government. And Macron is fresh and he's young and he's got the winds in his sails, and they call him Jupiter for a reason. And so he goes off. But what was interesting is that so far one doesn't get the sense that it's a nationalist venture. You know, I am going for France, but I'm also going for Europe, which is at the other end of the Asian landmass. Anyway, you know, some of this is all us, you know, kind of as, you know, acting as conduits of a message rather than a reality to create this road, this trunk road, metaphorical and physical, that will bind the Asian landmass to China is the work of decades and, you know, close to $1 trillion. Even a man as young as Macron won't be there at the finish, and certainly Xi, even though they'll still be quoting his thought because he's now as almost as important as Mao, they'll be quoting Xi Jinping thought if this thing ever gets done, which remains to be seen.
But, you know, we get, I don't think it's too bad to get caught up on, you know, the symbolism, you know, the horse, the arrival to see yet again the terracotta army to kind of, you know, underline the fact that we've always been great and we've always had power and we've always had big armies. But despite all that, there seems to be some affinity between the two men. They seem to have some kind of understanding. And it's also interesting that when Macron talks about China, he talks about it in a very positive light. It's history, its values and qualities. Whereas, you know, this is where we talk about the absence of, you know, America from the table. You can't imagine that conversation between Donald Trump, for example, and the Chinese leader. There is something more positive there.
There is, although I may have to look through the French press tomorrow to see if anyone quotes Napoleon saying, "Let China sleep." I'm not entirely sure that will happen. Yeah, you know, look, he's in this position. Both men have their domestic constituencies to play to, although one actually gets voted on and the other one doesn't. But I don't know. I don't know. I just think, we're in this new era. There is this entire dynamic that's developing between what China, the reality that China can now create globally in terms of trade, and, you know, whether it can sustain this, because it is actually new steps, isn't it?
I think the interesting thing about China, and what in some ways makes it easier for leaders like Macron to do business with it, is that their interests are very much in terms of economic power rather than political. They want economic influence, but whereas other resurgent empires like Russia and Turkey want to be deeply and politically involved across regions, China seems to be fairly clear that it's all about business. It's all about economy. I mean, if you look at Syria, for instance, right at the beginning of the civil war, when everyone was sort of lining up and taking their sides, Russia and China came out very strongly in favor of Assad, which at the time seemed kind of strange and wrongheaded. And whereas Russia got ever more involved militarily in Syria, the Chinese they've sent some military advisors, but they've definitely kept out of that sort of political quagmire. So if what they want is economic bonuses and business interests rather than political capital, makes it rather simpler than some other of the major players in the world right now.
And lastly, when you think about gifts for dear ones, what do you think about giving a horse, Michael?
I think it's actually, it suits them both down to the ground.
Well, China likes lending a panda here and there.
Yeah, but yes, I know. But, you know, just remember that the Mongols came out of the Central Asian steppes riding horses and conquered all before them. I think the symbolism is not without merit. And, you know, let's be honest, you know, if you've ever seen horse guards go by, you know, whether here in London or on the 14th of July going down the Champs-Élysées, there is something quite stirring about seeing, you know, a cavalry charger going down the road. And I think that it probably will go down a treat out there.
The awful thing is that Theresa May is due to visit shortly. I wonder what she's going to bring. Perhaps a donkey, maybe?
A good British pig or something.
A Madame Tussauds waxwork Boris Johnson.
And also the horse is called Vesuvius, which is a very nice name, but Vesuvius did erupt and kill quite a lot of people. So slightly dangerous, dangerous beast at times as well. Well, we're going to move on because... we're going to continue to Israel, because the country has now published a list of organisations supporting a boycott against Israel. And any activists who have been involved with them will be barred from entering the country. Daniela, will this help Israel's cause and its security in any sense?
Well, I mean, define Israel's cause and security. I mean, I think this is a very bad and anti-democratic idea, and it brings up all kinds of rather amusing situations, not least that anybody in the world of Jewish heritage can automatically apply for Israeli citizenship. So you'll have this situation where many Jewish people supporting boycott, divestment, and sanctions will be able to, at the same time, apply for citizenship of Israel. And there are all kinds of clauses built in to exemptions for humanitarian reasons. Also, rather deliciously, Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the opposition, is a patron of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, which is one of Britain's biggest pro-Palestinian movements, which is on the list. So, as a senior figure, perhaps, in that, would that mean that he was denied entry to Israel? The whole thing is another horribly populist move, which has been popular domestically, because the idea of a boycott in Israel is extremely, extremely unpopular. But as to what effect...
Just to bring Michael in, so the calls for boycott have been there for a very long time. But why the decision to move now? Is it because they're seen to be effective, these calls, or...?
No, this has to do with the state of domestic politics in Israel, where... believe it or not, Benjamin Netanyahu is not quite as in control as you might think. And he's outflanked on the right, not on the left. I mean, the voices from the left who would say, look, BDS is not necessarily the way to get this government to change course, have very little purchase at the moment. The left in Israel is scattered and doesn't have a great deal of direct political power, whereas the forces of the right do. And, you know, boycotts, you know, saying, well, if you boycott us, then you can't come into our country is a pretty easy sop. It's populist, as Daniela said. But you end up immediately making mistakes. Just for example, I mean, among the groups on the list is the American Friends Service Committee, which is a Quaker organization. And in 1947, they won the Nobel Peace Prize. For what? For aiding Jewish refugees escape the Nazis throughout World War II. So now you've taken this organization that has, you know, strong ties into the Jewish community, and you're saying, well, no, you can't send your representatives. We won't allow them into the country. There's a lot of banning talk going on in Israel at the moment, and it's not just about BDS. You know, there are, you know, right-wing rabbis who will say that I am not Jewish because, well, I'm an atheist, for one thing. You know, I'm a secular Jew. I come from that tradition in our community. But they are wanting to increase, you know, the idea that religion is the essential core of Judaism. And you know, because politics have become so fractured and everybody is being pandered to essentially by the Likud party so that they can stay in power, you end up with these insane situations, with these lists. When national leaders start drawing up lists, it never ends well.
So it sounds, Michael, to paraphrase you don't believe this will work or is a good thing. But on the other side, do you believe in the boycott?
Asking me directly, I think about it a lot. I'm not sure I do. I understand why people would call for it. And, you know, people say, well, it worked on apartheid Africa, South Africa. And yes, it did, although it took, 30 years, a long time. But partially what people forget when they talk about boycotts is that in South Africa, as I understand it, the ANC itself and the majority said, look, we would like you to organize this boycott. It will help our cause. Whereas in Israel, you know, on the left, people would say, well, look, first of all, it isn't an exact match with apartheid. And second of all, when you talk about boycott, divest, you're talking about boycotting scholarship and, you know, Israeli universities. Daniela is shaking her head. Come on. What are you talking about, man? Quit wriggling. Stop it right now.
I take it you're a little bit more...
Daniela is...
Pro a boycott.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that at all. Okay. But I would say that the boycott movement is a response to a call by Palestinian civil society to boycott Israel. And boycotts are blunt instruments and can be quite painful. I mean, I would describe myself as a boycott agnostic. I travel to Israel. I write for an Israeli newspaper. I have no problem buying Israeli goods. However, I do think BDS is a legitimate, non-violent and legal form of resistance, which is proving effective, because its real effect is not to destroy Israel's economy. Israel's economy has never been better, but it's to destroy Israel's brand in the world. It's to taint it. Mm-hmm. So when an artist like Lorde wants to play there, it automatically becomes
an
issue.
And there the pressure was enough to stop it. But exactly. Is there no kind of bitter taste in the idea that, you know, we know what happened in the late 30s when the German government called on people to boycott Jewish businesses and not trade with Jews and to impoverish them by not doing business with them?
Well, of course, and this is why it's so painful and so sensitive in Israel. And I have no doubt at all that there are some anti-Semites who are part of the boycott movement. However, as I said, it's a call for action that doesn't involve the suicide bombings that I covered at length in the last decade, and the violence that we see in Israel and in Palestine. The occupation is also quite violent on a daily basis. So whether it's unpleasant or uncomfortable or not, whether it won't succeed in convincing Israelis that, well, actually, their way is wrong. But then again, dialogue over the last 20 years has also not achieved much either.
But now that you bring that up, I mean, essentially, it's yet another form of gesture politics, because the Israeli brand, the Israeli self-image is nobody likes us and we don't care. Israel is the Millwall of nation states. We laugh, but it is true.
It's true.
Israelis, you know, if you talk about the late 30s and who came to the rescue of the Jews of Europe, it will be centuries, possibly millennia, possibly a whole new series of books added to the Bible or the Talmud about, you know, when it comes down to it, no one will come to your rescue. So if they want to boycott, you know, it's a gesture. It won't change a thing about Israeli society.
Israeli Jews have a point when they say, just look around the neighbourhood at all the countries you're not suggesting we boycott, where you can jump across a few borders and you can find people, you know, stoned to death for adultery. You know, and you're not saying, you know, don't buy their products. Why are you saying to us that we should be held up to a higher standard of judgment?
Exactly. That resonates very much. That is the argument that Israelis use. And I'm not a representative of the BDS movement, but the argument is that Israel is or wants to be seen as a Western democracy and part of the family of nations. And while there are sanctions on human rights abusers like Syria, and there have been famously sanctions on Iran, Israel has an ongoing military occupation that's entered its 51st year. And so this is, again, a civil society call. The point is, though, whether it will destroy Israel's economy or Israel's brand, Israel sees it as an existential threat. There is massive, massive efforts in government, a whole ministry dedicated to combating it. Jewish communities around the world mobilized to try and fight it. So the Israelis are scared of something.
Well, you're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Michael Goldfarb and Daniela Peled. And we'll be staying within the region next when we look at Saudi Arabia and why football stadiums are going to be opening their doors to women for the first time.
Visit our online shop where you can find items designed by our in-house team and collaborations with the brands that we love. Discover everything from luggage and clothes to stationery and back issues of the magazine, as well as our book series and popular travel guides. We deliver worldwide and offer high-quality customer service. And don't forget to let us know if you're a Monocle subscriber to enjoy your 10% discount. Go to monocle.com/shop and browse away. Or if you're in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, London, New York or Toronto, visit us at one of our shops and we'll take care of you personally. See you around.
Welcome back, and you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Michael Goldfarb and Daniela Peled. Well, women in Saudi Arabia are going to be allowed to attend football matches on Friday for the first time in the Conservative Kingdom. This is a continuation of a series of reforms driven by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who's trying to modernise the country and shed its reputation as an ultra-conservative destination. Well, Michael, if Saudi Arabia wants to become less reliant on oil and to attract more foreign investments, are these the kinds of moves that are actually maybe a little bit of window dressing, but significant in signposting change?
Well, they get headlines. Just think, women can now drive to the footy. They can drive, park the car themselves, sit up on the terraces. It's a gesture. And you can't say more than that. I mean, in terms of whether it will, make international womanhood suddenly think that, Saudi Arabia is actually a place I might want to visit, I think is probably not the case. But if it does begin to bring some change to domestic relations inside households in Saudi Arabia, then, it's great that women will be afforded this pleasure as well as going to the cinema. And, who knows what other, cultural joys they can find.
Daniel, some of the things which happen around these reforms seem to be more interesting than reforms in a way that there does seem to be an ability now for, in certain places, men and women to mix more freely and share their ideas and to meet unchaperoned. There does seem to be a change in how women are being perceived in the society in more interesting ways. But something like this football decision, we know that women have been arrested in the past for attempting to go to football matches and attempting to go to sports arenas where they've been banned. Do you think this is a real moment of change for Saudi Arabia?
Forgive me for being extremely underwhelmed about this. It is, as you said, headline grabbing. We're talking about this now. I think it's a sign of how extremely low our expectations were set of Saudi Arabia. The idea that a woman should be able to go to a football match should be seen as progress. As I understand it, she'll still need the permission of a male guardian. Look, Saudi Arabia is massively resource-cursed and is in many ways a basket case. And it doesn't need foreign investment to revive its economy. It needs an actual economy that works. It needs people to have jobs and access to the workplace and a domestic economy as well. It has to have the environment where women can work. I mean, women are fairly highly educated in Saudi Arabia, and I think more than 50% of the university graduates are women, but they're not working because the conditions to work, are just impossible. Well, maybe now they will be able to drive themselves to work, theoretically, but having spent decades ramming home an extremely conservative version of Islam, I think they're going to have a MBS, as he's commonly known, jovially known, is going to have quite a task to change social attitudes.
And, as an outsider, the other thing that always seems complicated is when you meet Saudi women here in London who are often here studying or doing medical research, they live as kind of Western women. There's a kind of strange game that's played that when you go abroad, it's okay, you're out of sight of the kingdom now. You can get on and live your life like anybody else.
But this is one of the reasons, Andrew, that I when I came back from my one and only extended reporting trip in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, I decided it was the most cynical place on earth, because if you come from a certain class and have a certain amount of money, you can buy your way out of all these restrictions. You can buy your way out because you can come up to London to be educated, for example, or maintain an apartment in Paris or London or New York or Boston, wherever, and live as a Westerner. And the quid pro quo of that is to keep silent when you go home and accept that you're that you live in this country that's essentially a feudal monarchy, and until recently really was quite, you know, feudal in terms of how it was run. I mean, the Crown Prince seems to be interested in making some social changes. It isn't the same as going to the Gulf states where, you know, women can work, and yes, there's still an incredibly patriarchal society and they're under a lot of restriction. But in Saudi, they've got a long, long, long way to go. And the people who will benefit from it most, I fear, will be the same ones who can escape to London from the heat of Riyadh in the summer and come here and enjoy the cool and the rain of an English June.
Well, we're going to stay with the issue of women's empowerment and why it's probably needed in more countries than Saudi, because powerful speeches about Hollywood's sexual abuse scandal dominated the Golden Globe Awards last night. Oprah Winfrey had this to say as she collected an honorary award.
New day is on the horizon. And when that new day finally dawns, it will be because of a lot of magnificent women, many of whom are right here in this room tonight, and some pretty phenomenal men fighting hard to make sure that they become the leaders who take us to the time when nobody ever has to say me too again.
Oprah Winfrey there. Daniela, the beginning of a new dawn?
Well, is this the beginning of a presidential race for Oprah Winfrey? Plenty of people have been saying, oh, is she going to be the Democrat candidate? Well, right now, with the current playing field, it might not be such a bad idea. I don't know. The whole shtick where women were wearing black to symbolise the tragedy of sexual assault left me a little bit cold. But I do think the fact people are talking about Me Too and so on, and not just in Hollywood, but across the social spectrum, I do think that does signal a massive movement of social change. Just the fact that people are talking about it. And it's had a domino effect, and it's had a continuing effect. It's very hard to think of any industry that isn't plagued by sexual harassment, journalism included. So while these big gestures, you know, we're kind of inevitable and I'm not particularly moved by them. Yeah, I think things are changing.
Michael, what did you make of the speech?
Well, I mean, it was, we just heard the end of it. I mean, she built to it. I mean, the whole thing, you know, she started quite quietly. I mean, I had a little problem with it, but it's just me, I'm sure. The first part of the speech was actually a history lesson about a woman who in Jim Crow, Alabama in 1946 was dragged off the street by six white men and raped, and is still alive. And she was on her, the woman was on her way from home from church, and she's been open about her story. And I would guess that Oprah will eventually be making a movie about this woman. And to me, it grates a little to take that kind of violence against women and compare it to some of the allegations, not Harvey Weinstein, obviously, but I mean, there are much lesser allegations about, you know, I don't know, inappropriate touching and that sort of thing. And I really had a problem with that. However, you know, it is what it is. And because America in particular is a celebrity-fixated culture in which, you know, people pay attention to this stuff, then, you know, she used the platform that she had and she gave a real barnstormer of a speech. Although I'm not sure it's enough to carry her to 2020 and the nomination.
But what's interesting is that reaction in the room. There's, you know, a sense that, you know, here's an industry where, you know, the casting couch has been a reality for some men, but certainly for a lot of women for a long, long time. It's just been part and parcel of it. And this, I guess, that's the new dawn bit. It feels like
it's going to be very hard for anyone to play those games in the future. That the women in the audience were standing up because it felt that many things, they indignities they had suffered in silence, were being brought together in one room, and they were there together for each other. There was some emotion in that room. That was the thing that I thought was powerful.
Well, I don't want to be the person with an outburst of cynicism, but a lot of the people in that room were also playing the game and continuing with the whole. I mean, it is La La Land after all. But certainly, if women don't feel able to speak out about inappropriate touching, they're not going to be able to speak out about serious assault. So it's certainly a change.
Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. Daniela Pellet and Michael Goldfarb, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Leia Furnia. And our studio manager was Christy Evans. More music next. And at 1900 hours, it's The Culture with Robert Bound. And we'll have more on the day's main news stories on The Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Midori House is going to be back at the very same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But for me, Andrew Tuck, thank you and goodbye.